This episode of Shameless is brought to you by the ICC Women's T20 World Cup. Be part of history this International Women's Day, March 8, with the world's best women's cricketers and Katy Perry performing live.
The most important thing I have is the ability to tell stories and to tell my story, and I just need to tell it the way I want to tell it and not let anyone else have it.
Welcome to Shameless, the pop culture podcast for smart women who love dumb stuff. Today on the show, we're joined by the very clever, very funny Rosie Wardland. Rosie is a writer and comedian who began her career writing recaps of The Bachelor for Mamma Mia. They were recaps so funny and recaps that went so viral, she arguably became a more recognisable name than the contestants themselves. Since her recap days, Rosie has written two best-selling books, The Anti-Cool Girl and Every Lie I've Ever Told, hosted an award-winning podcast called My Mum Says My Memoir is a Lie, has toured Australia with two sold-out one-woman shows with a third coming, and written for TV too. Oh, and just last year, she signed a two-book deal with HarperCollins Australia, announcing her foray into fiction. But despite all of that dizzying career success, Rosie is still dealing with the fallout of a traumatic childhood, which manifested into post-traumatic stress disorder and ongoing mental health battles. Here, she talks about all of it, the success, the low points, and how Rosie Wardland became one of the most successful writers in the country. Just a note on this one, we do cover issues in this chat around suicide, addictions, and details of childhood trauma, so it may be triggering for some listeners. Here's Rosie. Rosie Wardland, welcome finally to Shameless in Conversation.
I know, finally. We've been trying for so long.
We've been desperate to get you on. And I feel like we, because we worked at Mamma Mia, a little bit of overlap, I think, when you were there. But you, during Zara and my time when we were lowly interns, were like the star of the show. So I think I came up through Mamma Mia being like, oh my God, Rosie Wardland's in the building
today. That's so funny. Because I started off as a lowly intern also. And that'd be you guys now. You're the big stars.
No,
now.
I feel like we're still lowly.
I know. Like always and forever.
That's what you don't know how to tell people. You never stop feeling like a lowly intern. You always do. Yeah.
Rosie, we start every In Conversation episode with the same question. Mm-hmm. We didn't actually prep you for this, so
no,
we'll see
no
how you go on the
coming.
Fly.
Okay.
What are you reading, watching, or listening to at the moment that you would recommend to another woman?
Oh, okay. I just finished watching Cheer on Netflix.
I haven't seen an episode.
Oh, it's so good. It is amazing. And I think it's only like 5 episodes, but I swear to God, I knew nothing about it. And by the end, I was like, if Jerry doesn't make Matt for Daytona, I'm going to freak out. Like, I knew all the lingo. I was so into it. It was just nuts. The athleticism that goes into it that you don't realize is crazy.
I really need to watch it.
It's the kind of thing that I'm seeing headlines and articles about everywhere and you just feel so out of the loop.
Yeah, it is just so good. And it's going to go on to be like a whole show now because people are obsessed with
this. Is it like the new Dance Moms?
A little, because the coach is nuts. Like, and this is scary because these kids fall and like break their bodies.
Okay.
It's intense, but they're all so into it. And the nutso thing is, in the US, you play, or you are a cheerleader in college, and then after college, there's no professional cheerleading as a sport. Mm. So you get to do it for those 4 years, and then that's it. It's over. So they're all just so obsessed with getting as much out of it as they can before they never get to do it again.
What a strange culture.
I know.
Festers then.
I know. It's so weird.
I think we need to watch it on the flight home.
I reckon.
You should.
All right, let's download it. Rosie, tell us about the family you were born into.
Oh my gosh, okay. Well, I was born while my parents were on the run from drug dealers, which is usually a good way to like set the tone of what my childhood was. My parents were both addicts and alcoholics, and my dad had schizophrenia and my mum has bipolar. And it was an interesting, tumultuous time, my childhood. we were in and out of the foster family, my sisters and I, the foster system, and living with our mom occasionally, living with other family members, 20 different schools. I can't even count the amount of houses. So, yeah, pretty, I guess I would say, unique.
I would say that also. When you look back, I'm curious, what emotion do you feel? I mean, you revisit that part of your life, or you did in previous parts of your career often, and you turned it into art. How do you feel when you look back at that time?
I've gotten better at it. I mean, I was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder when I was about 17. I started having like panic attacks and flashbacks and anxiety and that kind of thing. And so I've been in therapy since then with the same psychiatrist. So
same one.
Yeah, so we're coming up on our 17th year together.
Okay. Oh, my God.
Because I'm about to turn 34. Yeah, so it's a lot of therapy, but aside from the therapy, a huge part of what's helped the last 10 or so years has been taking a lot of the stories from my childhood and telling them in the way I want to tell them, like really owning that narrative. I felt like gave me a lot of control back over what happened to me. And also making it funny has really helped. I mean, there's that saying, you know, if you don't, what is it? If you don't laugh, you'll cry. So you might as well laugh. And I feel like I've really gotten to that place.
Yeah.
So
did those experiences draw you closer to your sisters? What's your relationship with your sisters like?
Well, I have three sisters. I have one older, Rhiannon, she's 36. And then there's Taylor, who's 25, and Bella, who's 21. And we were split. Like basically we stayed together in some foster homes and some care situations, but it's so hard to place four girls together. And so when I was 14, I went to live with an uncle, and Rhiannon just moved out on her own because she was 17, and Taylor went into the foster system and Bella went with her dad. And so we didn't see Bella for 11 years, and we saw Taylor on and off, but not a lot. So it was really up to us to sort of make sure that we had a family unit together, because we didn't really have one otherwise. I mean, our mum's not super consistent in that department. Like, she's in our lives, but if we wanted to have a family, it had to be each other.
Like, so you guys are organising family Christmas.
Yes, yeah. We do. Yeah, we have for, I mean, it helped, I think, that Rhiannon had a kid when she was 17. So Rhiannon had Alira, who's 17 now. Oh my gosh. She just started year 12. And I think because Rhiannon had a baby quite young, she had to grow up very fast, and we sort of had to build what we tried to make a normal family situation for her.
Mm. Going back a bit before you were all separated and went into foster care and you went with your uncle, yeah. You told Australian Story in what was a pretty searing piece last year, and we'll pop it in the show notes for people who haven't watched it, that you never felt safe around your dad ever. Yeah. Can you speak to that relationship a little bit?
Yeah, well, he was a very intense alcoholic, and also he had schizophrenia, which I didn't know at the time. I didn't find out till I was a grown-up from other family members that he had schizophrenia. So he would do strange things. As a kid, I just thought my dad drank too much. That's sort of what I understood. But he could also be quite violent, never towards my sister and I. It's my sister Rhiannon and I, he's our dad. Never towards us, but towards other people, like, you know, walking down the street if he thought somebody looked at him weird, or, you know, because he just had the paranoia from his mental illness. And he would, you know, sometimes I would hear him arguing with someone on the phone and I would pick up the other phone and he was talking to no one. So he just was, and he would constantly pass out. Like, the amount of times Rhiannon and I were at the shops with him and he'd be so drunk that he would just collapse in the middle of the floor. And he also had this thing with, this is actually quite funny because I feel like this is all sounding quite dire, and it's like, how do I tell funny stories about this? But he used to he was obsessed with shoplifting. He really liked shoplifting, but what he didn't realize was he was so effing drunk all the time that he was terrible at it.
Like, the world's worst shoplifter. Yeah,
no, like, one's stealth when they're drunk.
He was so stealth, and I would be with him and I'd be like 5 or 6, And I would just see him, like, stumble into a shop. And it was usually things for my sisters and I, like Polly Pockets or toys or weird stuff. And he would just pick it up off a shelf and just, like, shove it down his pants just in full view of everyone. And I'd just be sitting there going, oh, my God, we're going to get kicked out of this shopping center again. And, like, we sort of became known to local security guards. Oh, like, no. They would come and they'd be like, okay, Tony, you're going to have to take that out of your pants. And, like... And me and my sister would just be like, oh, my God. And, mostly adults were really lovely. Like, they would say, come on, Tony, just don't make us do this in front of the girls. Like, you know, so I can see the humor in it now. But as a kid, I just had a constant feeling of, like, heaviness in the pit of my stomach. And I would throw up a lot, which in hindsight I understand now was, you know, pretty intense anxiety. But as a kid, I didn't know what it was. I just knew that. My dad made me feel sick all the time with worry.
One element of your book that I think stood out to me the most, your first book, The Anti-Cool Girl, and your podcast that you did on that, I listened to both. I listened to that entire series, by the way, despite already reading the book. I was like, I want it again. One element that really stood out to me for years ever since that was the relief you felt when your dad passed or that lifting feeling. Can you speak to that? Because you were 8 when he died.
Yeah.
And I can imagine after 8 years of trauma and anxiety caused by this man, it would feel very conflicting to feel that sense of relief.
Yeah. I think a lot of kids have that ambivalence with their parents when they've had parents who are abusive or neglectful or scary like that. You know, he had done something particularly violent and awful in the few days before he took his own life. And that was probably one of the scariest nights of my life, what he did that night. You can read it in my book and it's on the podcast. And I remember just thinking, why does my mum let us stay here alone? Because she used to send us to stay with him for school holidays and stuff. And I remember my sister and I got in the car after that visit and we just said, don't ever make us come back here again, please, please, please. And a few days later, he passed away. And I just, my mum sat us down and told us, and my older sister burst into tears. And I remember I went to school that day because there was a dress-up competition and I'd worked really hard on my costume. And I also thought, just quietly, well, if they know my dad died, then I'll definitely win.
This is my moment.
Did you win?
No.
You're fucking kidding me.
I didn't even win. I got like some participation lollies, like highly commended lollies, but I didn't win first prize. So I was like, excusez-moi.
That was a pretty funny element of your first memoir, I think, that your sister was always like the one who was chosen.
Yeah.
And you had to watch that happen again and again.
I know.
I feel like everyone with a sister can relate to that feeling of feeling like, fuck.
I know, particularly an older sister. Like Rhiannon was just so effortlessly cool and beautiful, and I was so desperate to be a performer and so desperate to be like, what I wouldn't have given for a stage mother, you have no idea. Like, I was just so desperate to always be on and to be entertaining people. And Rhiannon just could not give an F. Like, it wasn't her thing. And, like, I entered this modeling competition once, like, one of those ones where they have just the little setup in the middle of a crappy shopping center and they take you into, like, they've just put up some barriers and you go in. And I went in and I picked my outfit and it was my birthday present being in this modeling competition. I can see you're laughing because you know what's going to happen.
No, because you know what? I also applied for modeling competitions when I was a kid and my sister was always like, they'd see her.
Don't spoil it.
But my sister would always go further and I'd be like, why am I not a model?
I know. Well, anyway, so I went in and I did it and I was obviously a bit shithouse and my sister didn't even enter and the photographer came out and saw my sister waiting with my mum and was like, oh my God, will you please let me photograph her? And I was like, I just paid $90 and that please let me photograph your other daughter. And Rhiannon was like, oh, fine. And so Rhiannon just goes in and just stands there for 1 minute, gets her photo taken. And like a month later, we get a call that she'd won the entire effing thing. And she's in like freaking Kmart, like catalogs. And meanwhile, I'm like desperate for an Oscar and she just did not care.
I'm more astounded that they can charge you $90 to enter a modeling contest when you're a teenager.
Oh, no. Teenager, hello, I was like 7. It was like a kids modeling contest.
Oh, my God, what a money-making scheme.
I know.
Rosie, apart from modeling competitions then, what did your life look like after he passed? It was the four of you and your mum under the same roof. How did that go?
Well, we hadn't been living with him for a long time. My mum, they were together when I was little, and my mum started making quite good money as a sex worker. And so that kind of gave her the economic means to leave him. And she left us as well with him for a while because she was like, I'm outie, kids and family. And so she went off to Sydney for a long time. She left when I was about 6 weeks old. And so we were with our dad alone for a long time. And then she met this guy in the Navy from Hawaii and she married him, I think because she wanted a holiday. And then she finally said she wanted me and Rhiannon, so we moved to Hawaii with her. And then after about a year, she was like, he said, oh, I've been transferred to Minnesota where it's like minus 30 degrees every day. And my mum was like, okay, bye. And so we just, I remember once he was on the ship, like, because he had to go on the ship for like 3 nights a week or something. And the second he left, mum was like, quick, get your stuff together. And we just ran to the airport and just never went back.
Oh my gosh. Were you happy that you were leaving and going back home?
I didn't quite understand. I mean, I liked where we lived, and people say like, oh wow, Hawaii, that must have been amazing. I'm like, it's, to me the memories are the same as Australia. I can't really tell the difference. It's not like you're, when you live in Hawaii, you just live in a regular suburb. Like, we lived in Honolulu, but we weren't in, like, you know,
surfing every morning
by the beach. Yeah, yeah,
we're wearing Lays to school.
Yeah, exactly. Well, they thought we rode kangaroos to school, you know what I mean? Yeah. So everyone has their own, but yeah, we just lived in a regular neighborhood. And I mean, I remember I was sad to be leaving my friends at school, but I didn't really get what was happening. Mm. And so when we came back, we never lived with my dad again after that. So when he died, it didn't have a huge impact on the practical side of how we lived, but it had a huge impact on my mother, who up until then had been drinking a lot. Like, she was certainly an alcoholic, but after my dad died, it just got a lot worse. She says he was the love of her life. I don't, so that's why.
Does she still say that?
She still says that, yeah. Mm. Even though she was married to someone else when he died, but.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You went to more than 20 schools across your childhood.
About that.
Which is, like, to think about that is just how much change and starting over and leaving is incredible. What was the love of writing and drama like throughout those years?
I just always really liked telling stories. I really, really liked it. And I was good at writing from when I was very little. It's something I just took to quite easily. And I kept a lot of journals. And I do remember understanding that there was something interesting about my life that would be worth a story one day. Like, I do remember thinking, like, whenever my parents did something stupid, like, I'm writing all of this down.
Pop,
like,
this in the memory bank.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, did you know it was different to the other kids' lives?
When you get to school, you know. When you get to school. I don't think we realized before then, but yeah, when you get to school and also when you start going to other kids' houses and you realize, oh, it's not normal to feel really nervous and unsafe and like you're going to throw up all the time, and it's not normal to have a dad who collapses in the street and like beats people up, and it's not normal for your mum to take off for 3 weeks at a time. Like, you sort of, it's normal for you, but it's when you get to school that you realize not everybody else lives like that. And you start to get jealous too. You start to wish that you had other lives. That's why I got really obsessed with television, because I was so obsessed with having a life like the ones I saw on TV.
When did you know that you were good at writing?
I don't know. I mean, I think I started like winning contests and stuff when I was quite little. And also I used school as a way to like prove I was worthy, I think. I think kids who've had childhoods like mine, they go one of two ways. They either become crazy overachievers just to try and make sure that any adult they're around doesn't want to leave them, or they act out because they think, well, what's the point? Because no one's around anyway. I think my older sister went that way. She like got into partying and like, you know, she started doing drugs and drinking when she was quite young. And I was just like, impress the adults at all costs. And so I was like very studious and very like goody two shoes. And so I liked doing well academically. And that was what I was good at.
Was there an element of escapism with the drama and writing?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And television as well. Like, I've had a TV in my room from since I was like 4 or 5 years old. And something about loving the stories on television, but also to me, television as a career and like wanting to create it was something that I wanted to do from when I was really, really young. Like, I just thought, whatever that is, like, I want to do what they do. Like, I want to make that and be that and do that. And, you know, when I was little, I just wanted to be the star of everything. But then as I got older, I realized like writing was probably what I was much better at. But yeah, it was just about knowing that there was something outside of my very chaotic little life that was better.
Coming up after the break, Rosie talks about turning her trauma into art. But first, a word from our sponsor. Was it 8 or so years ago that you first submitted to Mamma Mia?
Oh, my goodness.
I'm trying to remember when I first started seeing your name pop up on the
site. Yeah, I think it was 2013.
Yeah.
Because you were writing blogs and your friend Tony pushed you to submit to Mamma Mia. Is that
no,
right?
No, I wasn't even writing blogs. You know, it was totally all a scam. So I
no, we love a scam.
Wait, let me explain. So like I went to drama school for 3 years and then I did creative writing at uni for 3 years, and so I was qualified to do nothing. So I was working in a call center and a friend of mine had something published on Mamma Mia, and I remember I read it and I was like, I'm a better writer than that. Like, and so I thought, I should, like, why aren't I being more proactive? And so I said to Tony, okay, I'm going to submit something to this Mamma Mia thing. And he was like, well, you can't just submit it. Like, you need to, like, start a blog and, like, do. And
you reverse engineered
yes,
a blog.
I did. So I, like, wrote the piece that I was going to send them, and then I wrote a few other pieces. And then I got Tony, because I had no idea how to do it. So I got Tony to set up a blog, and he like backdated the pieces so it looked like I'd been publishing things for like a couple of months. And then I sent the piece off to Mamma Mia, because they just had like a submissions email. And it was just like, hi, I'm Rosie. I'm a writer. I'm a blogger. Here's a link to my blog.
I'm and, very like, chill.
Yeah, and Tony had also set up like a Twitter, and like, and so he was like, here's my Twitter, and like, here's this piece. And so, yeah, I didn't really have a blog. I just said that so they wouldn't think I was legit.
And how long did it take for them? It was Jam, wasn't it? Jamila Rizvi, the then editor-in-chief, who got back in touch. How long did it take her to really sift through to find you?
I think she got back like the next day. I wrote a piece that I knew would get published. Like, I basically wrote a troll piece. I wrote a piece about how when or if I have children, I'll definitely have a C-section, because I just don't see the point in not taking advantage of modern medicine. Like, why rip your vag apart and go through all that pain?
Such a good way to get Mamma Mia.
I was going
to
say.
And I legitimately do believe it's true, because I did have an argument with a boyfriend once when I told him this. I was like, I'm going to have a C-section. And he was like, don't you feel like it's just something as a woman you're meant to go through? And I was like,
fuck no.
Yeah, no. And so anyway, I do legitimately think that. But I hammed it up a bit for the piece, knowing what they would want to publish. And so Jam got back and was like, yes, we'll publish it. And I remember it was my first experience of like, hate online hatred. Like, so many people were really mad, but a lot of people were like, yeah. And so anyway, Jam was like, if you have anything else, send it through. So then I just started writing other funny bits and pieces, and they kept publishing them. And then after, I think it was like maybe a month or so, they said, oh, you've written so much for us and we've got this sponsored cruise. So do you want to go on this cruise and write about it, like, as a thank you for all the pieces? And I was like, this is the pinnacle of my career. Like, I just thought it was the best thing ever. So I went on this cruise and I wrote about it for them. And that was over Christmas. And then in the new year, Jam was like, do you want a job? And I was like, okay. So
We wanted to ask you about how formative that relationship has been, you and Jam, and sort of the impact that she had on your career and still, I would imagine, continues to have. Can you speak to that for a moment?
Oh, my gosh. Well, Jam's like one of my best, closest friends now. She, because I was so shy when I started at Mamma Mia. I was so just broken and nerve. My mental health had not been great. My PTSD had been really intense and I sort of had shut myself away from the world. I'd gained a lot of weight and I just was very nervous about being an active part of the real world. And so I very tentatively started going into Mamma Mia. I was very nervous and Jam was just so supportive work-wise, but also in a personal, emotional way, was really lovely to me, as was Mia at the time, was really lovely. They really put in a concerted effort to kind of bring me out of my shell. And it was within a few months, like I barely talked above a whisper when I was first there. And a few months later, I was like head of the social committee and like getting everyone out. Like it was just like I just needed this tiny push to sort of get back to who I was. And they gave that to me. And they also were pretty generous with letting me write what I wanted to write. Because when you're the low-level person at Mamma Mia, you're kind of the shit kicker who has to just write whatever needs to be written. So if there's a news thing or if there's a pop culture thing or if there's a listicle, it's just like you do the dregs of what's left over, which is fine. That's all editorial assistant jobs. But, you know, they'd put me on news and they'd be like, yeah, we're never putting you on that again.
Just be bad enough at something?
Well,
no.
Because I didn't train as a journalist. I trained as a performer and a writer.
It's a different thing.
It's an entirely different skill to be a news writer and be like creative writer.
And so I, you know, I would do those things and I picked up the basics of how to, you know, write. Mamma Mia has, you know, notoriously very quick turnarounds of content and so you'd be writing 5 or 6 pieces a day. So I got good at doing it. But mostly the pieces I wrote that were like personal, humorous kind of essays, they got big numbers, and numbers and clicks are what matter to websites like that. And so because I was good at writing them, they said, okay, well, your time is worth more doing that kind of thing than doing news. And then I started doing the Bachelor recaps and they got really popular. And so then I sort of had a bit of autonomy over what I wanted to write. And to be honest, a lot of it came from Jamila giving me the best piece of advice she ever has work-wise. And I still tell this to everyone who asks me how to get to where I am. Or people say to me, how do I write like you? And I say, well, first of all, don't write like me. Write like yourself. But Jamila said to me way back when, like, Rosie, you need to create a U-shaped hole wherever you work that no one else can fill. Like, because if you do that, you will be indispensable to the company you work for. And that's what I did. I mean, the kind of content I wrote for Mamma Mia, it was Rosie content. No one else could write it. So
I want to give a depiction because we worked there during that time where you were the major draw card of that company. Now, for people from the outside, they would know Rosie's recaps did very, very well. Let me paint you a picture. I think maybe out of there'd probably be 40 articles a day maybe going on the website during that time. You might write one. Your article on its own would get as much traffic as the other 39 combined. Like, literally not exaggerating, you were solely responsible for about half, maybe more, of the website's traffic. That is insane. Like, as people who have worked in digital media, I think anyone in the industry would know that is unheard of. What is it about the writing? What was it about the Bachelor recaps in particular that people adored so intently and came to you specifically so intently? Because you reached people who weren't even Mamma Mia readers.
Yeah. I still don't know. I mean, I didn't compromise how I did it. I find a lot of people who write online will – I mean, I just told you that I did it with that first article that I submitted, that you do what you think – the website wants and what you think people want. And that's fine to get clicks and whatever. But, you know, I got to a point where I was like, I'm just going to write what I think is funny. And so I just wrote it the way I liked it. I also think I never made a lot of nasty fun of the show, or particularly the girls on the show, because back then it was just The Bachelor. I just, you know, it was clever satire. It wasn't just a bitchy recap of what had happened that night. It was, you know, clever feminist satire. And I think it made people feel smart for watching something silly. But I still can't explain it.
Was it hard to not let it go to your head? Because it was like the attention on you and the adoration coming your way must have been overwhelming.
I have the most crushing low self-esteem. Like, so not really, like, it. I never really did, like, and I have such bad imposter syndrome. Like, I'm always panicked that it's all going to disappear and the next thing I write is going to be the thing that people don't think is funny. And there was this huge drama that happened when I put up this post. Oh, my God. So there was this girl who made friends with me.
Oh, I remember this.
Who was quite famous. She'd been on The Bachelor and she made friends with me. And I don't make friends easily, but we'd had similar childhoods and so we sort of connected over that. And I'd written really positively about her time on the show and so we met up and she asked me a lot about the recaps and how I write them and how I do it. And I sort of opened myself up to her in a way I rarely do because I'm quite shy. And then I found out a couple of weeks later she was writing her own recaps for one of our direct competitors. And I just felt so hurt. Because I thought I'd made a friend and then I was like, oh, I think I got used. And I was really angry and so I put up this post like, I do recaps and people think they're funny and I can't even remember what I said, but it was like, but, you know, like, yours will never be as funny as me and, like, get fucked. Like, because I was just, like, angry and bitter and overreacting and I was, like, pissed off.
Especially if you're feeling lonely in your life and you feel like you've finally made a connection with someone and that's taken away from you. That's
And so anyway,
shit.
So I just wrote that. No, I put it on my public Facebook because I had blocked her from my personal one because I was, like, very upset. And then I knew she'll know that it's for her. You know what I mean? And so then I just went to bed and I woke up in the morning and it was like national trending news that Rosie thinks that she invented recaps and no one else is as good as writing them as her and no one else can, like, she thinks that, like, she should be the only one allowed to write them and look at this post she wrote and she's so up herself. And I was like, no, wait. Rewind.
It's like, hang on, guys, wait up.
I was like, wait, what happened? And so then I, like, tried. I went on and I was like, I can explain this. And I went on and I was like, no, guys. This is aimed at one girl who did something shitty and I was really upset with her and I wrote the post to her because I was mad about this thing that she did. I was like, I don't think I invented recaps. I was like, I started writing them because I loved other ones I'd read. Like, and so anyway, I was like, so that'll fix it. And then 10 minutes later, it was like, we don't care what you said. Like, it just, that made it worse.
Like Rosie doubles down.
Yes, it was. It was like, it was my first experience of getting like hatred because so much of the energy directed towards me was very positive, everything I wrote. And oh my God, I had like a mental breakdown that day. Like I had people... They were tagging me in all their comments and posts and tweets, like just saying Rosie is like a – can I swear?
Yeah.
Like Rosie is a fucking dickhead and Rosie's up herself and like how could Rosie have such a big head? And what was so ironic to me is I was like, you don't realize I have the lowest self-esteem of anyone you've ever met. Like I can't even – and I had like quite prominent people, famous women in media – privately messaging me saying you are like you have fucking embarrassed yourself, like you are a fucking joke, and I'll tell you afterwards.
Oh, I can't wait.
Like, you know, I had really cruel, incessant, non-stop, and like eventually I just put up a post and I said, like, please, I'm even like shaking right now talking about it. It was the worst day, and I said, look, I'm not handling this. You're all still going to be talking about it. Can you just stop tagging me in it? Like, I can't, please stop tagging me in all of this because, like, mentally, I'm not handling this very well. And I thought, like, people would say, wow, okay. But no, that just, they were like, oh, Rosie doesn't want us to tag her at Rosie Waterland. And, like, it was just the most intense thing. And what's interesting is, like, it all blew over eventually, but there are still some people who, when my name comes up, they say, oh, Rosie's that dickhead who thinks she invented recaps or whatever. But the last, probably the last 12 months or so, I've had about 3 or 4 different people contact me who were some of the worst people that day to say, you know, I feel like I just want to reach out. A couple years ago, I said some really awful stuff about you online. And I think the attitude towards internet pylons is changing, and people are getting more of an understanding of what it means to go after someone online. And we didn't really have that because this was like 2015, I think. So yeah, the last year or so, I've had quite a few people reach out to me and apologize.
Isn't that interesting? Did it change your perspective on pylon culture? I think it's such a unique thing to talk about because I think a lot of people listening won't really understand the terror of being in the public eye and being terrified that you're going to misstep and for it to happen again. But the reality is, when you're writing online and speaking on podcasts as much as you are, something's going to come out. Do you know what I mean?
Of course.
That's just natural. Like, we're human and flawed people.
Yeah.
Did it change your perspective in terms of, like, you didn't want to criticize people online as much because you knew how it felt to be at the bottom of it?
Oh, yeah. I was petrified for a long time after that. And I really censored myself. Like, because, you know, it's no secret that Mamma Mia, and, you know, not just Mamma Mia, most of those kinds of websites, they crave kind of provocative content because that's what gets clicks. Mm. Like, you know, people arguing about something, and so opportunities would come up where I would say, oh, you know, I was kind of thinking about something that, I don't know, Kyle Sanderland said that kind of annoyed me, and Mia would just be like, write it, go and write it right now. And I would just say, nah, don't want to, not anymore. Whereas a year before that, I would have just been like, totally, here's my opinion that I haven't really thought a lot about, but I'm just going to quickly get it done and off it goes. Whereas after that, I was just so scared of ever getting piled on like that again. And I was really embarrassed as well, because a lot of people that I really respected, like a lot of comedians and, like I said, a lot of online female writers were really cruel to me. And I was upset that they were cruel, but I was also embarrassed that they thought I was a piece of shit because I liked and respected them so much. Mm. And I was like, oh my God, I hated that I thought everyone thought I was a dickhead.
I think that's the most difficult aspect of this kind of work, in that everything you do is public.
Yeah.
And you don't have a boss, but sometimes it does feel like the audience or the community will hold you to account for even small things. What is your relationship with regret like? Because I know that's something that Zara and I have been working through a lot over the last 12 months, that sometimes you will make mistakes or sometimes you will say things that you regret and you can't necessarily take them back, and it's out there and it's done. And I think I personally have had to work through regretting things that are already out there.
Yeah.
How do you deal with regret?
Look, it's a lot easier for me now because I virtually opted out of doing opinion after. I don't really do opinion anymore. And that whole incident has a lot to do with it. And, you know, my podcast that I do now, Just the Gist, isn't really what you guys do, in that we don't talk about, like, we don't spend a huge amount of time talking about current news events and our opinions on them and stuff. Like, so I am not often in that situation anymore, like you guys are in every week. But I will say that towards the end at Mamma Mia, I realized that the best thing to do is to just own it when you F up. Like, just say, you know what, I said something dumb and I didn't realize, and I'm just going to do my best to learn from it and move on. I think it's when people double down that it makes it worse. Mm. I mean, it's very easy for people in our position to say, like, you know, you don't know how easy it is to F up, and you don't know how easy it is to say the wrong thing. But it is, it's true. And I think as our opinions about pylon culture and cancel culture and all that kind of stuff grow and develop, and we realize the human toll it actually takes, I think people will come to appreciate a genuine apology more, because you can't just cancel someone forever. I mean, and if we don't listen to and attempt to forgive people who are genuinely sorry for and want to learn from a mistake they've made, then what incentive is there for them to ever
do better?
Yeah,
do better
and grow.
Exactly.
Yeah, for sure.
Hey guys, just Mish and I popping in here very, very quickly because we wanted to tell you a little bit about a fundraiser we're doing with our co-working space, Just Co, on February 18.
We are doing an intimate career Q&A event at Just Co's William Street space where we'll be chatting all things business, rejection and entrepreneurship. So if you've got questions around building a brand, growing an audience for your podcast or how we taught ourselves to run a business with absolutely no knowledge, whatever Zara, come down and chat with us.
To support communities affected by the fires, all ticket proceeds from this event will be donated to the Red Cross Bushfire Appeal. The event will be held on Tuesday, the 18th of February at 6 p.m. and tickets cost $45. But we have a special code for you and all proceeds will be going to the Red Cross. Mish, tell them the code.
That special code is SHAMELESS. Very creative, I know. Just SHAMELESS, all capital letters at the checkout. That gives you $20 off that $45 ticket price. So click on the Eventbrite link in our show notes, grab a ticket, come talk all things career with us, Zara.
We will see you guys there.
Through a lot of the work that you've been doing, you said at the very beginning you made a lot of art out of your struggle, but you also made a lot of art out of your struggles with mental health.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever get really tired of that?
Yes. Yes. I mean, it's that trap you fall into when you – and I fell into this trap at Mamma Mia, and it's a huge part of why I ended up leaving is just that I didn't want to write about myself personally all the time. Like – and, you know, you tell these stories and then you reveal more and you reveal more and you reveal more. And then it gets to a point where it's like, well, what dramatic, huge thing are you going to reveal next?
It's like you have or to one-up yourself.
Yeah. And it's like, that's not me. I'm a good writer as a craft. Like I wrote my memoir and I told the story of my childhood because I had an interesting story to tell. And then I also wrote about my mental health stuff because that was, you know, I worked at a place that wanted me to write columns about myself. So I did. But then, you know, there were weeks when I had nothing and it was like, we'll come up with something. And I was like, but nothing dramatic happened to me this week, unfortunately.
Ate a kebab, watched some TV.
Yeah, like, and so that's when I started realizing that it was time for me, I think, to move on. You know, I'm a trained writer and a trained storyteller. I mean, I joke about being not qualified to do anything, but 6 years of drama school and 6 years of creative writing essentially means I'm a trained storyteller. And I take a lot of pride in that skill, and I take that skill very seriously. And I just got to the point where I, you know, didn't have a lot left to write about. I didn't want to keep mining my trauma for entertainment. And so, you know,
it's very traumatizing as well, I imagine.
It can be, yeah. And I mean, that's what my show at the moment, Kid Chameleon, is my stand-up show this year. And that's essentially what it's about, is that I spent a long time writing and talking about this stuff. And then I sort of decided I wanted to leave it be. But then I handed the story over to a couple other projects. So I did the podcast with my mum, Mum Says My Memoir Is a Lie, you know, in which we sat down together and we went through my first book and she basically contested everything I wrote because she says it's all lies and I made it all up. And you know, it was a very entertaining podcast and people find it extremely fascinating to listen to. And it's had like, you know, 7 million downloads and it won an award. And I knew, the creative person in me knew it was going to be great content, but it was re-traumatizing doing it. And part of me wishes I hadn't done it, because allowing her to take back control of the narrative that I'd fought so hard to take control of myself really messed with me mentally. And the other thing that I talk about in my show is that when I did Australian Story, I ended up back in psychiatric hospital after doing that. Because really? It was the same thing in that, you know, I was handing over control of my narrative to other people, which, given how important it was to me to have had control of that, that was a very vulnerable position to be in. But you think, you know, well, it's Australian Story, so it'll be fine.
Yeah, like I've got to do it. Yeah.
I won't... It's an excellent show, a very well-respected show, but I will say that the way they handled my story and my sister's story and some of the things they asked me to do in order to film that story were very traumatizing. Mm. Like, they asked me to get into my pajamas and sit in a blanket fort in my house and act depressed so they could get shots of me looking depressed like I wrote about in my book, which I found very upsetting. And then they also asked me to I wrote in my second book about calling Jamila the night I attempted suicide, and they asked me to get into my pajamas. Oh, I'm going to even cry talking about it. I can't believe they asked me to do this. They asked me to get into my pajamas. I was in my house, and they said they were coming over just to film shots of me watching TV. And when they got there, the producer asked me to get into my pajamas. They were going to turn all the lights off, and they were going to take a camera from the outside and through the living room window. They wanted me to reenact the phone call I made to Jamila the night I tried to kill myself while they filmed it, so they could use that footage in the episode. And
what did you say?
I was going to say, do you have any power in that?
I cracked it.
Yeah.
I just said, no, I'm not.
This is not your content.
I can't believe you even asked me to do that. Like, I was so speechless. And I went into my bedroom and I, like, cried for a minute. I was like, I can't even. And so in the end, we compromised and I said, okay, you can film me in my pajamas just sitting on the couch and I'll look a bit sad. Like, because I didn't, I was just like, oh my God, I can't, you know, here's a compromise. And that was, you know, that's, I immediately regretted handing my story over to them. I was like, why did I do this? Like, you know, and the theme of my show is, you know, as a kid, I had to be a chameleon to survive. I had to shapeshift and adapt and sort of reassess every situation and switch and change. And the one thing that allowed me to sort of stand on steady ground and stop feeling like I had to be a chameleon all the time was finally telling my story. And then I, you know, handed it over to other people the last couple of years, and it was totally re-traumatizing. And so it wasn't, people don't know that the night Australian Story aired, I watched it from a psychiatric hospital because I was so messed up from the experience of filming it. And, you know, I've talked to them since then and I told them how awful it was, and they have been, they, the executive producer of the show has been amazing and it has been really lovely, and you know, organized a trauma counselor if me and my sisters wanted to talk to him. And but you know, it just, I think it just is, it just taught me that the most important thing I have is the ability to tell stories and to tell my story, and I just need to tell it the way I want to tell it and not let anyone else have it.
Totally.
You're also working on a book at the moment with Jamila Rizvi.
Two books, right? One fiction, one non-fiction.
Well, sorry.
Yeah. But not a lot on my plate.
I was going to say you're busy, but I think given what you were just talking about, the content of the book is quite interesting, the one you're writing with Jamila. It's about this huge gap between how we handle people with sort of physical brain injuries in comparison to sort of mental illness.
Yeah.
What do you think needs to be done in order to bridge the gap between how society and medical professionals deal with and talk about mental illness? Because clearly even people who are making television didn't understand how the trauma could be reignited through their work.
Yes. And I do think that's true. That's a good point. I think they just didn't understand that the things they were asking my sisters and I to do could be re-traumatizing. And I think after what happened with us and talking to them, they've taken it very seriously that, you know, they need to deal with instances of past trauma better. But, well, yeah, Jamila and I, because, you know, as Jamila's spoken about, she's had a benign brain tumor the last couple of years that's been incredibly disruptive and awful for her life. She's had two major brain surgeries. And we were talking about how when she first got out of hospital after her first surgery, she came home and there were 11 lasagnas that had been delivered by different friends and family. And I was like, oh, when I got out of hospital, I just went home and ordered Uber Eats by myself. and so that one anecdote just got us into a conversation that kept growing and growing and growing and growing, that I've had this incredibly debilitating, you know, mental health stuff that I've had to deal with throughout my 20s through the PTSD. And you know, they do say that childhood trauma, it affects the way your brain develops. So it is, in essence, a brain injury also. And she's had this incredibly traumatic brain injury from the tumor, yet her illness is taken far more seriously than mine. And of course, we're both writers, so we were like, let's write it. which is what we're doing now. I mean, I don't know. I don't have the answers. People always ask me for the answers, and I say, I don't know. I mean, I'm writing a book about it, so I hope that helps. I just think mental health needs to be taken more seriously across the board. Mm. And that, you know, comes from a macro and a micro level. It's, you know, it's society, it's the government, it's people. It's a lot of things. I wish I could solve the problem.
It's hard, right? Because I imagine so much of the work you've done in telling your own story has been incredibly helpful, but to expect people to tell their stories in order to fix the conversation is a huge load.
Yes, it is. And, you know, that's even this book has been hard for me because even little things, like Jamila said, okay, so I'm going to write a chapter about the day I, you know, went to the doctor and I hadn't been feeling well and I got a scan and I got diagnosed with a brain tumor. And she goes, so can you write your diagnosis story? And I was like, oh, well, I just had 17 years of trauma and then I was getting panic attacks all the time. And then I went to the doctor and I said, what's wrong with me? And he said, it's going to take a few years of therapy and I'm still in therapy. Like, I don't have a diagnosis story. Yeah. Like, mental health is not as clear cut. And so even, you know, figuring out how to make our stories kind of work together and compare and contrast them for the book, that's been a huge eye-opener for me because I'm like, oh, wow, how do I explain this in a way that is going to be helpful for people? But, you know, I do like the idea of this really being, like, one of the last things I ever write about my mental health.
Mm. Have you enjoyed writing fiction?
Oh, my God, yes.
I cannot wait to read your fiction.
When are we waiting for?
2021. So I'm writing it at the moment. It's due soon. It's basically a book. I'm kind of saying it's the new Bridget Jones's diary. Like, it's set in diary form, and it's about a girl who works at a women's website called Fempire. And her experiences and day-to-day life in that environment and her the rest of her life as well. So
I am,
you know,
so excited.
I don't know if it'll remind anyone of anything, but we'll just see when it comes out, I guess.
Yeah, we'll totally see.
But I cannot tell you how nice it is to go, oh my God, writing a book doesn't have to be an emotionally traumatic experience.
It can be fun.
Writing a book can actually be really fun to do. So, like, I'm so glad I've switched to fiction. It's the best.
That's so good. We have two questions to finish off with you. What is your career highlight? Because you've had so many, and we will, of course, list them at the very beginning of this episode. But what is your personal highlight? The day in your career when you went, you know what? I've fucking done really well here.
It was recently, actually, and it's not something that people will know about, but I am developing my own TV show that I'm also starring in and the head writer of. And a month ago, we had the writer's room for it, the very first writer's room. And I was sitting in a writer's room with this team of TV writers and producers there to write my show. And I was like, I did sort of take a second on the first day, like, this is my ultimate dream come true. Like, I can't believe I'm sitting here doing this. Like, that was
amazing. That is incredible. Yeah. That is so exciting.
I know, I'm really excited.
And the last question we always ask is, what is success to you? With all of this in mind, how do you feel successful?
I really just want to move into a house that I never have to move out of ever again. Then I will feel successful. And I know that's such a basic dream, but I've honestly just, I don't know what it feels like to have the security of just one place that you live and you never have to move. So that's when I'll feel like I've made it, when I can buy a house and live in it forever.
I think that's a wonderful dream. I think that's a wonderful measure of success.
Well, in
too.
Sydney, that's everyone.
I was going to say, yeah, good luck. Rosie, thank you so, so much. We have loved so much finally having you on. And thank you for giving up so much of yourself. You always seem to give up so much of yourself for the benefit of others. And we are so, so grateful to have been able to talk to you and listen to you. And we're so excited for your shows and your books and everything coming
out. Thank you so much. Oh, rosiewaterland.com.
In the show notes, we will do a blurb after that.
We'll do it.
I'm so bad at my
Thank you so much for listening to this In Conversation with Rosie Waterland. If you would like to hear and see more from Rosie, you can do a few things. The first is follow her on Instagram at Rosie Waterland. The second is download her podcast, Just the Gist. The third is head to one of her shows. Rosie is doing her Kid Chameleon show in Canberra on the 23rd of February and then heads to South Australia on the 25th. It's a critically acclaimed performance and tickets are about $40. We will pop the full list of her tour dates and where you can buy tickets in our show notes. As for us, well, if this is the first time you've ever listened to Shameless, hello! We interview influential people every Thursday, but we also do Monday episodes, which are a wrap of the week in pop culture and celebrity news. If you would like to hear more from us and be the first to know when an episode drops, just click that big purple subscribe button at the top of your Apple Podcast app or click follow on Spotify. We will be back in your ears on Monday.